You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, How to Turn Your Independent Film into a Money-Making Business by Alex Ferrari. For a free copy of the audiobook, head over to www.filmbizbook.com.
The Director Series is made possible by the support of our subscribers on Special. Subscribe today at special.tv/The Director Series and gain access to exclusive full-length Director Series episodes and other bonus content, ad-free. Welcome to the Director Series podcast, a show dedicated to deconstructing the work of some of cinema's most celebrated and influential film directors. I'm your host, Cameron Bile.
They drew from a wide variety of influences: Preston Sturges' Sullivan's Travels, Roman Polanski's Repulsion and The Tenant, and Stanley Kubrick's The Shining, in addition to numerous other literary references and traditions, to create a thoroughly postmodern tale about Barton Fink, a New York playwright who moves to Hollywood to write for the movies on the eve of America's entry into World War II. Initially intended as something of a diversionary project, the Coen's fourth feature, Barton Fink, taps into a primal aspect of the writer's psyche. Most writers want to create lasting, important works that inspire their audience, but these ambitions are usually incongruous with the commercial aspects of the profession. Hollywood has a long history of appropriating celebrated playwrights for the cinematic medium, and an even longer laundry list of brilliant ideas that were trampled over by populistic commercial schemes hatched by those who couldn't write their way out of a paper bag. Barton Fink covers this external aspect of the profession quite comprehensively, but it also spends a considerable amount of time exploring the writer's internal conflict, the debilitating uncertainty about whether the work at hand is something important or merely trash, when oftentimes the difference between the two is completely indistinguishable. By channeling these frustrations and unloading them onto their hapless, eponymous protagonist, the Coens managed to create one of the most inspired and celebrated works of their entire career.
Audrey, I need help. I know it's late and I shouldn't be calling you like this. Believe me, I wouldn't have if I could see any alternative, but I'm sorry. Listen, how are you? I'm sorry. You doing okay?
Who is this?
Barton, I'm sorry. It's Barton Fink.
Barton, I'm afraid it's not a good time.
I'm sorry. I just feel like I know I shouldn't ask. I just need some kind of help. I have a deadline tomorrow.
Set in Hollywood shortly before the bombing of Pearl Harbor, Barton Fink serves as one of the earliest showcases for actor John Turturro as a leading man, and he pours his heart and soul into his performance as the titular Jewish playwright with Coke bottle glasses and the battiest hairdo this side of a racer head. The character, as well as the central conceit of the story, is loosely based on New York playwright Clifford Odets, who worked to promote social issues in the Stanislavski method of performance through his work with the group theater during the 1930s. When his audience began to migrate towards escapist fare, Odets also moved to Los Angeles and became a working screenwriter. The Coens applied this basic template to their own ambitious protagonist, tailoring it specifically to Turturro's idiosyncratic strengths as a performer and isolating him within the mysterious labyrinth of the fictional Hotel Earl. Barton Fink went before cameras shortly after wrapping on Miller's Crossing, shooting for 8 weeks on a budget of $9 million. Likely owing to how fast the production of Barton Fink ramped up, the Coens pull from their roster of stock actors more heavily than usual. Such Coen Company regulars as John Goodman, John Polito, and Steve Buscemi are all heavily featured throughout the film.
Are you a trans or a res?
Excuse me?
Transient or resident?
I don't know. I mean, I'll be here indefinitely.
Res, that'll be $25.50 a week, payable in advance. Checkout time is 12 sharp, only you can forget about that on account of your res.
As the Hotel Earl's concierge, bellhop, and seemingly only employee, Chet, Buscemi plays up his natural weirdness to memorably inquisitive effect.
Right now, the contents of your head are the property of Capitol Pictures. If I was you, I would speak up, and pretty goddamn fast.
Polito pulls a 180-degree reversal from his Miller's Crossing character by assuming a quiet, bookish mentality in his performance as the studio lackey, Lou Breeze.
I know what it feels like when things get all balled up at the head office. It puts you through hell, Barton. So I help people out. I just wish someone would do as much for me.
Goodman outright steals the show as Charlie Meadows, a perpetually sweaty insurance salesman with a small brain and a big heart.
What kind of scribbler are you? Newspaper man, did you say?
No. Actually, I'm writing for the pictures now.
Pictures? Jesus! Oh, I'm sorry, brother. I was just sitting here thinking I was talking to some ambitious youngster eager to make good. Hell, you've got it made, writing for the pictures? Beating out that competition? And me being patronizing? Is the egg showing or what?
Always armed with a cheap colloquialism, Meadows is an endearing character who initiates a friendship with Fink by sheer virtue of being the only other visible inhabitant of the hotel. He's given a chance to shine in the film's show-stopping climax, an opportunity he relishes with a psychopathic fury and glee.
Look upon me! I'll show you the life of the mind!
Even the first-time cast members already seem to have that inimitable Coen Company touch.
All of us undomesticated rioters eventually make our way out here to the Great Salt Lick. That's probably why I always have such a powerful thirst.
John Mahoney, a Sphinx literary idol W.P. Mayhew, channels the alcoholic ghost of William Faulkner. His secretary and secret ghostwriter, Audrey Taylor, is played by Judy Davis with a dry glamour that's reminiscent of Katharine Hepburn.
I want to know how many of Bill's books you wrote!
Barton.
I want to know!
Barton, honestly. Only the last couple.
Ha!
Tony Shalhoub turns in a memorable performance as Ben Geisler, a producer with rapier wit and a rapid-fire verbosity.
You're confused. You need guidance? Talk to another writer.
Who?
Oh, Jesus. You throw a rock in here, you'll hit one. Do me a favor, Fink. Throw it hard.
Finally, there's Michael Lerner, that venerable character actor of corrupt bureaucrat types. He absolutely devours the scenery as Jack Lipnick, a greedy Hollywood titan and the de facto owner of Fink's soul.
The writer is king here at Capitol Pictures. You don't believe me? Take a look at your paycheck at the end of every week. That's what we think of the writer.
He's cut from the same cloth as other larger-than-life producers like Albert Broccoli or David O. Selznick, which makes him a perfect foil to Barton's artistic integrity.
Feeling? I got 20 writers under contract! I can ask for a Fink-type thing from!
Over the course of their career, one of the Coens' most valuable collaborators has been cinematographer Roger Deakins. Barton Fink marks their first time working together, and it becomes quickly apparent that this is a match made in heaven. Deakins, who filled the role after Barry Sonnenfeld left to pursue a directing career of his own, crafts a darkly handsome 35mm film image highly suited for both the 1940s time period and the Coens' unique visual sensibilities. The vintage 166:1 canvas deals in the same tobacco-toned color palette and classical camera moves as Miller's Crossing, albeit with a heavily impressionistic panache that echoes Frank's interior state and lends the film a sweaty, dreamlike quality. The keys of Fink's typewriter strike paper like deafening clashes of thunder. The chaos of a rowdy brawl at a USO party manifests in woozy, canted angle slow motion. The creeping one-point perspective compositions in the Art Deco-styled Hotel Earl conjure haunting memories of The Shining's Overlook Hotel. All these expressionistic moments, and more, are blended together into a feverish lather by returning composer Carter Burwell, and the Coens themselves under their editing pseudonym Roderick Janes, an alter ego whose existence owes to guild regulations. One of the Coens' distinct directorial talents is the ability to imbue a relatively simple story with multiple layers of subtle thematic context. Barton Fink has an uneasy feeling that courses underneath the plot, like something crawling under your skin, or, more aptly, wallpaper sweating off the walls, entire sheets at a time. The Coens leave the true meaning of the plot's developments just ambiguous enough so as to stoke all kinds of fan theories about what's actually going on. The chief interpretation being Fink's contract with Hollywood serving as a metaphorical deal with the devil, and the hotel in which he languishes in limbo being a gateway to hell itself. Artifacts like the shoes of the Hotel Earl's residence are seen, but we never actually glimpse the residents themselves. We only hear their mysterious individual dramas between the walls. Audrey Taylor's mysterious murder halfway through the film promptly veers the story into a waking nightmare, culminating in Goodman emerging as Lucifer himself amidst the raging inferno that has engulfed the hotel.
Heil Hitler.
It's almost as if the Coens knew how thoroughly audiences and critics would dissect their vision, peppering in deliberate images that point in that direction without bearing any particular relevance to the plot, like Charlie Meadows' mysterious box that may or may not contain a severed head, numerous references to the Bible, or the camera traveling down the drain of a bathroom sink during a sex scene. Barton Fink continues to build out the particular character of the Coen's self-contained universe by rearranging recurring ideas and themes within the context of Hollywood's golden age. The narrative framework of an East Coast playwright transplanted to California echoes the outsider's perspective the Coens bring to their sense of storytelling. Like so many Coen protagonists, Barton Fink is a man at odds against his environment, railing against a system that encouraged exploitation, mediocrity, and profit over artistic integrity, even as his own writer's block pits his productivity against his desire to create. Up until this point, the Coens had fashioned their protagonists in the mold of the common man, but Barton Fink flips the script on the formula by making the titular character an entrenched member of the high society intelligentsia, who lionizes himself as a warrior for the middle class.
I feel I'm on the brink of success.
I'd say you're already enjoying some.
No, a real success. The success we've been dreaming about. The creation of a new living theater of and about and for the common man.
He's so intent on promoting middle-class values, even, that he frequently talks of the very people whose plight he romanticizes, ignoring the very real human stories they have to share.
I could feel my butt getting sore already.
Exactly, Charlie. You understand what I'm saying a lot more than some of these literary types, because you're a real man.
And I could tell you some stories.
Sure you could, and yet many writers do everything in their power to insulate themselves from the common man, from where they live, from where they trade, from where they fight and love and converse and...
He commodifies their hardships in a misguided campaign to stroke his own ego, just as his own talents are commodified by the head of Capitol Pictures in a vain attempt to gain prestige.
The important thing is we all wanted to have that Barton Fink feeling. I mean, I guess we all have that Barton Fink feeling. But since you're Barton Fink, I'm assuming you have it in spades.
It should also be noted that the Capitol Pictures depicted in Barton Fink is the same studio seen in Hail Caesar, further solidifying the interconnectivity of the Coenverse. As a film that started life as a simple diversionary project, Barton Fink exceeded nearly every expectation to become the Coens' first true masterpiece. Perhaps unsurprisingly, given the tastes of mainstream audiences, the film was a financial bomb, but what it lacked in box office receipts it more than made up for in critical plaudits. Barton Fink holds the esteemed distinction as the only film to win the top three awards at the Cannes Film Festival, Best Actor, Best Director, and the Palme d'Or. It also went on to gain three Oscar nominations, Best Art Direction, Best Costume Design, and a Best Supporting Actor nod for Michael Lerner. The earliest instance of the Coens' artistic aesthetic coalescing into something truly identifiable as their own, Barton Fink has grown in appreciation over the years to become not just a cornerstone of the brothers' filmography, but an indispensable cinematic treasure in its own right.
Thank you for listening to the Director Series. For a deeper dive into your favorite filmmakers, go to www.directorseries.net. The Director Series is made possible in large part by our generous supporters on Patreon. Please visit us at patreon.com/directorseries to see how your contribution enables the continued production of video essays and text articles on your favorite contemporary and classic film directors. Thank you.